As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, it's the League Cup, third round of cherished competition with its traditions of big scores and even bigger shirt numbers. Also, a tasty weekend in the Premier League with a North London derby and Chelsea Man City again. Will it be more Tuchel torture or Pep get a turn being the dominant one this time? Plus, Alonso taking the knee or the pee? And foreign refs, should the Premier League bring them in, especially if they can drive a lorry too? All this and more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hurrah! Thursday the 23rd of September, and unlike some, we're fielding a top lineup for our Carabao Cup week. We've got Tom Williams. Hello, Tom.
Hello, James.
Nice to see you. Also returning from The Athletic, Adam Crafton. Hello, Adam.
Hello, lovely to be back.
And from The Athletic and The Villa View, Dan Bardell.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. League Cup third round. What did you watch? Any, none, all of it? Dan?
I watched Aston Villa bow out on penalties last night to Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, and I also watched Liverpool dismantle Norwich the night before. But to be fair, a lot of watched the highlights of most games as well. It was an exciting round. There's quite a lot going on, a lot of goals, a lot of interest.
Yeah. We round two had already had an 8-0 and 3-6-0s. This time we had a 6-1, courtesy of Man City against Wycombe Wanderers, and also that 7-0 from Brentford over the Football League's lowest placed club, Oldham. Crikey, Tom, what were you across?
I watched Liverpool-Norwich. Liverpool quite comfortable victors in the end. But Norwich had chances, had a penalty saved. Christos Solis had a penalty saved at 1-0. And they could perhaps count themselves slightly unfortunate. And I watched Man United-West Ham last night, the shock of the round.
Adam, I think you also saw the United game.
Yeah, I saw large parts of it last night. I mean, it's just sort of... How many times, I don't know, on Totally Football Podcast, we tried to work out whether Manchester United are any good or lucky or whatever. They're actually all right last night, I thought. They just didn't really take the chances that they made.
But from a West Ham point of view, huge, no? First win there at Old Trafford since how long is it now? 2007 or
2007,
something?
2007, yeah.
Yeah, first ever win for David Moyes since leaving Manchester United. For United, Adam, as you hint at there, two defeats in three, although I guess their starting lineup might hint as to how highly the Carabao Cup ranks among their priorities.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it really matters as a competition, you know, whether United won that competition or not. I do think it matters that they could have done with just having those three or four extra games because their squad is so bloated. When you look at the players that were starting last night that won't be in the team this weekend. So you're talking, you know, players like, I don't know, Jesse Lingard, Jadon Sancho, Donny van de Beek, Victor Lindelof, Alex Telles, Diogo Dalo, Dean Henderson even, who's quite an ambitious number two that wants to, you know, that will need some games. And now all of a sudden, because they've also put themselves under pressure in the Champions League, you start to wonder, well, where are the games where Solskjaer will trust his squad enough to rotate? Or do you just sort of get left with this clutch of 7 or 8 players that don't get used very much until the FA Cup and the January transfer window comes around. So I think it's more from a squad management point of view that there could be a bit of a knock-on effect for Manchester United. My favourite part of the game, and I don't know if people have watched this back, but there was a run by Mark Noble at the end where it was all set up for him to crown off his very dramatic week against Manchester United with a goal. But it wasn't actually his miss that was the highlight. It was the fact that he's comfortably out-sprinted Diogo Dalo, who is about, 12, 13 years his junior, from the halfway line, leaving him about 10 yards behind on this sprint. And it just struck me that some of those Manchester United fringe players are perhaps a little bit more unfit than the supporters would like.
Diogo Dalli, I like to call him. A huge crowd for that game as well. Very impressive. What was it, 72,000?
Maybe they thought Ronaldo was coming. Also, very early days, but Jadon Sancho situation is becoming a little bit interesting in terms of the sort of lack of impact that he's made so far. And I know it's only been 3 or 4 starts, but it is an interesting one. I think it would probably be far more under the microscope if there wasn't sort of a far more famous player who had just arrived to the football club in Ronaldo. But I think Sancho is struggling at the moment to really make a mark. And I think even, you know, the fact that he started last night probably means he won't start in the Premier League at the weekend, I would think. So then it becomes, you know, you're getting into the October international break and he's yet to really come to the fore as a United player. I just think, you know, it's not alarm bells or anything like that, but I think it's definitely one that could escalate a little bit in the coming weeks in terms of the amount of scrutiny on his performances.
More on Man United shortly in their game of the weekend, because they're playing Villa, of course. But I insist that we talk a little bit more about West Ham before we move on. They've got Man City next, who I mentioned, 6-1 winners against Wickham. How did you feel about West Ham's performance, Tom?
Yeah, really impressive from West Ham, I thought. I mean, you look at the Manchester United team, and obviously it was a weakened team, 11 changes from the weekend. But David Moyes made 10 changes from the weekend. The only player who kept his place was Jared Bowen, who's an attacking midfielder who was playing as a centre-forward. He hands a debut to his goalkeeper, Alphonse Areola, gives game time to a lot of other players. And, you know, West Ham were under the cosh a little bit, but also at the same time, you know, in addition to the goal, which was quite nicely constructed down the right, Ryan Fredericks darting in, cutting the ball back, and Manuel Lanzini has sort of crept into space behind a sleepwalking Donny van der Beek to finish. And then the chances at the end of the game. There's that Mark Noble one-on-one that Dean Henderson saves. Andre Yarmolenko hit a post. There's a chance for Jared Bowen as well. And, you know, contrary to Manchester United, who haven't been able to sort of sustain their kind of league momentum in this competition, just further evidence of this kind of, this nascent feel-good factor, well, not even a nascent feel-good factor at West Ham, this sort of continuing feel-good factor at West Ham, continuing from last season, that they can go to Old Trafford, put out what is effectively a reserve team with a few round pegs in square holes, and come away with a really decent win.
Brilliant. All right, well, Man City in the fourth round towards the end of October. They've got Leeds this weekend in the Premier League. Other results midweek. Arsenal, 3-0 winners over AFC Wimbledon. Watford went out to Stoke. Everton went out. QPR on penalties, and spot kicks were needed elsewhere for Spurs in their win over Wolves. Leeds over Fulham. Saints at Sheffield United. And yes, Chelsea against Aston Villa. Dan.
Yeah, I thought that's the second time in recent weeks Villa have been to Stamford Bridge and been the better side. I thought that they were comfortably the better side in the first half of the league game. It doesn't seem to matter what Villa do. Chelsea seem to come out on top at the end. I was a little bit disappointed before the game with the team selection. There was a lot of changes. There wasn't any first teamers on the bench, which I think ultimately was our downfall at the end of the night, because I want Villa to win something. I haven't won anything since 1996. The Carabao Cup's a massive chance to go and do that and win that trophy. That's what a lot of supporters want to see. And that I think there was a little bit of initial disappointment when they saw the team. But then when you watched us play, a mixture of youth and fringe players, we really went for it and had a good go, responded well to going behind, scored a nice goal. Cameron Archer now 4 goals in the Carabao Cup this season. He's come from absolutely nowhere, because he hasn't been one of the youngsters that's been hyped up or spoken about at all, but he looks like a real finisher and his movement's very good as well. And it comes down to the lottery of penalties. But I think if Villa had had players on the bench to bring on, if they'd have put Watkins on the bench, maybe Ings on the bench, and had them to bring on late on in the game, because Chelsea threw on their big hitters in Lukaku and Mount, I think the game would have swung in Villa's favour, and I think perhaps we could have nicked something at the end of the game when we pegged them back. But it is what it is. We've gone out on penalties. I don't think any confidence will have been dented. Still think that those two performances against Chelsea are probably maybe the two best performances of the season for the club, but they just happen to be the two that they've lost. And I think Villa go into the game against Manchester United on Saturday full of confidence, and I think there's every chance that they walk away with something.
Ha! All right. Villa's record against United, as you know, Dan, not the best. I would imagine no. Dean Smith had the United game in mind when he kept so many of his first-teamers back for this trip to Stamford Bridge. Quick check on the other fourth round of fixtures that will be coming our way in late October. Chelsea, having beaten Villa, will take on Southampton. Arsenal will be up against Leeds. Stoke have Brentford. West Ham receive a visit from Man City. Leicester take on Brighton. It's Burnley Spurs, QPR Sunderland and Preston North End against Liverpool. Very evocative. All right, let's get on to the Premier League weekend with Man United, Villa and much, much more next.
America, a nation that has given us Europeans more than any other. Air travel, Google, Cardi B. But we've given them the greatest gift of all. Golf. And we're not going to let them be better at it than us. It's the Ryder Cup. And to celebrate, Paddy Power have a special offer. If your selection goes 3 up at any stage, get paid out as a winner. Paddy Power.
Applies to all pre-match singles on match result markets for four-ball foursomes and single matches only. Max payout £1,000. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay and the very best football writers around.
Premier League matchday 6 we're up to now. The weekend beginning with, look at this, a Champions League final rematch. Chelsea taking on Man City, 12:30 on Saturday. Also at 12:30 on Saturday, for reasons we'll get to shortly, Man United's clash with Aston Villa. Then you've got four games at 3 p.m. Leicester, Burnley, Everton, Norwich, Leeds, West Ham and Watford, Newcastle. Then Saturday concludes with Thomas Frank's fresh and fearless Brentford taking on Liverpool. Sunday it's Saints, Wolves at 2. Then at 4:30 there's the North London derby. Arsenal against Spurs, a rivalry almost as historic and bitter as the one that on Monday concludes the round, Crystal Palace, Brighton. Let's start with Saturday lunchtime and Chelsea, Man City, the rematch.
Havertz in a pocket of space. Anderson came and didn't get there. Chance for Chelsea. Goal for Chelsea. Kai Havertz in the Champions League final. Anderson couldn't get there. And Chelsea take the lead in Porto.
Yup, Chelsea, Man City, or to give it its official title, Tuchel versus Pep, part 4. Three times they faced each other this calendar year. All three of them have been Chelsea wins. What can football's ultimate galaxy brain come up with to end that run?
I mean, well, the team sheets will be eagerly anticipated after the ambitious tactical approach that Pep Guardiola adopted in the Champions League final, in what was, as we know, the starkest example of him overthinking a big game, certainly in his Manchester City tenure, possibly in his entire career. So it'll be interesting to see what sort of team he puts out. We know that City have got a few injury issues at centre-back. I think Ilkay Gundogan is doubtful as well. And going into this, okay, they had that pretty comfortable midweek win in the Carabao Cup, but really disappointing performance home to Southampton last weekend, 0-0. Didn't register a shot on target until the 90th minute. And of course, the great contrast between these two clubs in terms of their summer transfer activity was that Chelsea were the club who needed a striker and went out and got one, and Romelu Lukaku was already banging the goals in, and City were the club who needed a striker and didn't get one, and Ferran Torres has scored some goals in that position, but perhaps isn't going to be a durable long-term solution for them. So I think given Chelsea's slightly better start to the season, given the fact that Thomas Tuchel seemed to have the Indian sign over Guardiola in their three meetings last season, I think you'd have Chelsea as favourites here.
Okay, City didn't pick up a striker, but they did pick up Jack Grealish, of course, from Villa, Dan. Despite his departure, as you mentioned, that's twice that Villa have taken on Chelsea and been the better side. What in those performances do you think Man City could exploit to get the win this time?
The league game, which was the one where we caused them the most problems, but obviously ended up coming away with nothing and made it look like it was worse than it was by losing 3-0. It was getting amongst the deep midfielders. I mean, it was Saul and Kovacic that day. And Saul won't play against Manchester City. I don't think there's any way in which Tuchel risks that, because he doesn't look like he's up to speed with the pace of the English game yet. But it was that high press up against the midfield and exploiting the space between the slower elements of Chelsea's back three, where Villa really, really caused problems. Watkins high pressing, Ings high pressing, that's what they're very good at. I'm not sure Man City have got the personnel to do that across their front three. Torres had a great start of the season. Jesus seems to be playing more from the right-hand side. But he was not giving them the time on the ball that seemed to really ruffle Chelsea, and that was where Villa had some joy. So they'll probably have a different tactical approach against Man City. They'll probably be a little bit more secure at the back than perhaps they were. Maybe they underestimated Villa a little bit, but I guess the big thing selection-wise is going to be Pep had a reluctance to play a defensive midfielder in that famous Champions League final. I think with the doubts over Gundogan and Rodri, he's probably only got one defensive midfielder to choose from in this game, and it's Fernandinho, who is a fantastic player, but obviously he's at the wrong end of his career now. Chelsea's midfield so strong. I think Kante went off at half-time last night, so I'm not sure whether that was fitness or whether it was tactical. But the midfield is going to be a really key area in this game, and it'll be interesting to see how both teams line up.
Adam, what do you think?
It's a huge week for City. I mean, they've got Chelsea away, then they've got PSG away, and then they finish the week at Anfield, which is probably just about the hardest week possible in world football at the moment. Maybe not PSG on current form, to be fair, but certainly Chelsea and Liverpool. I think Dan raises a really good point about Fernandinho, who by sort of accounts of reports against Southampton last weekend, he had one of those games which I suppose players start to have when they get into their, you know, mid to late 30s, which just starts to suggest, you know, that they're on the turn a little bit. I think City need to avoid losing both. I mean, if they're to lose both of these games, it means they go into that October international break potentially 9 points behind. And you don't fancy Chelsea and Liverpool this time around to be blowing that kind of lead. They look so strong and solid as teams that you can't really see them losing that many games. So City need to get a mark down. They've put themselves under a little bit of pressure. But I agree with the guys. You know, they've got issues down the spine of the team now, City. They've certainly not got their centre-backs fully fit. Central midfield is a bit of doubt. I don't think De Bruyne is back to his best after injury just yet. And they've not, you know, we don't know who's going to play up front. One of the things I think they could exploit with Chelsea is, a bit like Watkins had that bit of luck for Villa against them. I think Son, was it up against Rudiger last weekend in the first half where he seemed to break in behind a few times. But I'm not sure who the natural player is at City that would be able to do that, to really, you know, really do that tireless running. Maybe it's Raheem Sterling, but then him and Pep don't seem to be, you know, necessarily on, you know, the best of terms at the moment.
They did get Phil Foden back midweek in the victory over Wickham, and he looked full of legs.
Yeah, but I've never really seen him play that. I mean, I'm almost wanting someone for Man City to play a Craig Bellamy-style role, which is just running those channels against those three centre-halves, taking them out of position a little bit and being very, very selfless. Maybe Ferran Torres or Foden or Sterling can do that. It's also an interesting comparison when you think the equivalent fixture last season was probably the one that confirmed once and for all that Frank Lampard was doomed, and City were absolutely stunning. I think it was the first half, they were 3-0 up last year, and they were stunning, and that was the game that really started to set City on course to winning the title after a slow start. So I think it will tell us a lot about the direction of travel for both teams since then. City obviously still a fantastic team, but it's just the nature of the way the fixture have fallen that you would think if this week goes wrong for them, it might be quite difficult. Also because Chelsea, you know, they have had tough fixtures. They've gone to Arsenal, that might not be a tough fixture. They've gone to Arsenal, they've gone to Liverpool.
Certainly isn't.
They've gone to Liverpool, been to Spurs. All of these fixtures sounded a lot harder before the games than after the games. And obviously they've got City as well. So it's not like Chelsea have a run of fixtures around the corner where you think, oh, they're going to be dropping points before Christmas. So important City get something.
I would say Lukaku up against Ake would concern me. Ake has had a decent start to the season, but he's the kind of opponent who I think Ake would struggle to deal with. I've seen opponents like that causing trouble in the past for Man City. If Man City had their first choice back line, you know, you'd probably feel a little bit more confident. But with the defensive midfield element, with the centre-back options being down to the last two, I think it's the kind of thing that Lukaku will thrive upon, and I think he'll be the main difference in this game.
Well, one potential absentee for Chelsea is the goalkeeper, Edouard Mendy, who's in a race against pain and a race against time, according to his manager, Thomas Tuchel, of his chances of returning to the lineup. Chelsea yet concede a goal from open play in the Premier League this season. Just that one Mo Salah penalty that they've conceded so far. One other kind of element to this fixture is our friend Marcos Alonso, who announced this week that he's unilaterally decided to stop taking the knee before kickoff, claiming the anti-racism gesture is losing strength. He has been doing this for a couple of games, I think, now, and instead points to the Premier League No Room for Racism badge on his sleeve. He admits that he hasn't spoken to his teammates about the decision, but confirms, "I'm fully against racism and I'm against every type of discrimination." It's up to the individual, but I think the whole thing about this gesture is it's powerful largely because of the solidarity, you know, the display of solidarity. And I think there was an excellent article on the Athletic about this, about the fact that it represents backing up your teammates. So it does seem strange that he wouldn't have talked to anyone else in the team. Also, when you got Nigel Farage taking your corner in certain publications, it doesn't fill you with confidence that you're on the right side of history. But I don't know, what do you guys think?
Yeah, it's a weird one. I think particularly the fact that he hasn't consulted any of his teammates. I mean, we know that Wilfried Zaha at Crystal Palace has for a little while now not been taking the knee. But he is black. He is someone who has had first-hand experience of racism and sadly continues to do so. Marcos Alonso, as a white player with black teammates, has an opportunity to make sure that he's on the same page as those players, but has decided unilaterally that it's not for him. I just find it slightly peculiar. And as you say, if you've got Nigel Farage banging the drum for you, I think you might want to revisit your motivations.
I find it a bizarre statement, as if pointing to an anti-racism message on your shirt. Is this some kind of grand gesture that's replacing taking the knee? I mean, I don't understand what he thinks is the difference between the two. Surely that the taking of the knee and having that unification is a bigger statement than just pointing to something that's on your shirt. It just makes no sense to me. The fact he hasn't consulted anyone at all, it doesn't sit well at all. I mean, I've been at games where I have heard, and it is a small element, people booing the taking of the knee. So as long as that's happening, it's still important. The players have explained what it is. They've explained why they do it. I just think it doesn't look good on Alonso at all.
It's hard to think of a more weak gesture than just pointing to a badge as
exactly.
Well.
Like, yeah.
Like visually, it's just such a limp thing to replace taking the knee with.
It's quite a remarkable commitment, though, to football's news cycle in a Carabao Cup week. Where people were worried we may not have anything to talk about whatsoever. Marcos Alonso has produced the goods quite spectacularly. The thing I can't really understand is he says that the message has, you know, has lost its resonance, but surely by then not doing it and not consulting your teammates, you're further undermining this gesture that you're saying you're worried is losing its resonance. I didn't really like Thomas Tuchel's comments actually either when asked about it, and he was then, you know, basically saying, you know, he almost suggested that, you know, Alonso's stance could be the wake-up call that we need. And I'm not really sure, you know, what was being awoken by Marcos Alonso's single stance, you know, against the knee and in favour of pointing at the slogan. Look, I mean, I think there are, like, very legitimate questions that have been raised by, you know, black coaches, technical directors and players about whether the gesture is being backed up by the action and policies that they would like to see by football governing bodies, also, you know, above that, on a legislative level, both about, you know, social media and beyond as well. I mean, I was encouraged because I was at the West Ham Manchester United game on Sunday, and when the players took the knee, it was complete support for it. There was no boos, there was no murmurs, it was just cheers. So that to me suggested, you know, this is something that has gradually won public support, and you saw that also in public opinion polling before and after the Euros, that the percentage of the British public who supported taking the knee had grown. So it is working in terms of changing public opinion. Whether it's working in terms of providing the perfect legislative environment for black people to thrive in sport is maybe a different question.
I must admit, with Thomas Tuchel's comments, I did think he was trying to just be pleasant and put a positive spin on things and say, well, at least it's got us talking about this issue again, because there might be the danger that the gesture becomes so normalised by its repetition that people stop to kind of recognise what it's about. So in that sense, I kind of get what I think he was trying to say, but there you go. That's Marcus Alonso. Anyway, Chelsea coming into this weekend, three clear of Man City, level with Liverpool and Man United, who, Dan, host your Aston Villa in the other 12:30 kickoff this Saturday. Dan, as you're aware, this was originally scheduled for 3 o'clock, but has been moved because of a gig by the Cortinas at the local cricket club. It's the Cortinas. They've got support from Johnny Marr, Blossoms and the Big Moon. It's quite a lineup.
Yeah, I mean, I feel sorry for the fans that are going, that had purchased travel arrangements around a 3 o'clock kickoff, because I presume this gig was not last minute, but yet the game was only moved a couple of weeks ago, which doesn't make much sense to me at all. But I guess the fans don't seem to be at the forefront of people's minds when they're making these arrangements with kickoff times, because there's all kinds of strange things that are going on. But I guess we may as well talk about the penalty that Manchester United are going to get at Saturday lunchtime already, because they've had three penalties in the last three games against Villa, a couple of them very, very dubious. And Manchester United haven't had a penalty yet this season, so we may as well start talking about that now.
Excellent. Excellent. United have that phenomenal record against Villa, Dan, unbeaten in the last 18 meetings, 14 victories, 4 draws in that time. Why is it? I mean, apart from penalties.
I've absolutely no idea, but I remember my second season, I was 7 or 8 as a season ticket holder. It was that famous you don't win anything with kids game, and Villa beat Manchester United at home in 1995. And then that hasn't happened again since. And we're now in 2021 and I'm still waiting to watch Villa beat Manchester United at Villa Park. And the record at Old Trafford hasn't been much better either. It's just a complete bogey side. Every team will say they've got bogey sides. I don't know what it is about them, but this is beyond a bogey team. Now, it doesn't matter what Manchester United are doing at the time. It doesn't matter what Aston Villa are doing at the time. There's just absolutely no way that we win games. Even if we play well, we just go there and we get beat. I do actually, stupidly, with all that in mind, fancy us to cause them problems at the weekend. I think I watched Ronaldo's first game against Newcastle and I thought 4-1 flattered Manchester United quite heavily, and I thought Newcastle caused them a lot of issues on the break, which is what I can see Villa doing with this new three at the back system with two up front, Watkins and Ings. I can see us being dangerous on the break against Manchester United, but then I know that penalty's coming and I know it'll be at a crucial point.
An impassioned rant there, but young boys have caused United problems. At West Ham, we saw last weekend, came within a better Mark Noble spot kick of taking points off them. Villa last weekend beating Everton 3-0 with that incredible 20-minute vignette from Leon Bailey. Is he going to be fit this weekend?
From what I hear, no, which is a blow, because he looked very, very dangerous when he came on for that 21-minute cameo against Everton. He's an incredible signing for Villa. He is going to be the Grealish replacement. For all that Christian Perslow's talked about Ings, Buendia and Bailey offering a combination of the things that Grealish offers, plus I think Ings obviously adds the goals in, Bailey is an excellent signing for Villa. He's a player who's operating at a level above, I would have thought, what we were capable of getting in the transfer window. If you look at his stats in the Bundesliga last season for wingers, he's up there with the Bayern Munich players in terms of productivity. So I think he's a sensational signing. But unfortunately, we've only seen cameos of him so far. He just hasn't managed to stay fit. He had a good cameo against Watford on day one when we were 3-0 down. We ended up losing that game 3-2 and he made an impact. And then he came on and did what he did against Everton. I think with his pace, the way he carries the ball, his set-piece delivery, how direct he is, he's going to be a hell of a player. But we just need to get him fit.
All right. Came off in the 84th minute, I think, against Everton and very much in doubt for this weekend. Adam, so you were watching Man United live last weekend and you've already expressed your kind of ongoing doubts about whether you're watching a good club, a club that's going places or not. Do you share Dan's pessimism about Villa's chances? Or is it optimism? Actually, there were definitely some flashes of optimism despite yourself there.
Giving myself room to manoeuvre.
Adam, what do you think?
It was a cunning blend of both, I think.
I thought Man United were actually good at West Ham last weekend, which when I then listened to sort of podcasts and read reports afterwards, no one really seemed to agree with that. But I thought the first half in particular was one of their better performances of the season. And I think it helped them a lot having McTominay back in midfield after he's been out for a few games. Makes Fred a bit less bad to have McTominay next to him. But you don't know what you're going to get from game to game. And then even within the game, they have these 15-minute periods where they look like they could be a really great team. Then they have a 15-minute period where they look like they're going to get their manager sacked. Then they have another 15-minute period where nothing really happens. And you keep thinking each week, well, at some point this will consolidate into becoming a really good team or just sort of falling apart. And it just doesn't. It just sort of rumbles on with these weird periods between games where you just don't know how good they are. But what we do know they have is a lot of really good individuals that can produce moments. And that's only been further underpinned by signing probably the best individual on current form in the world in Ronaldo. And his movement is unbelievable. I was sort of sat level with the penalty area last weekend, and his movement in the final third and the speed of it is sensational. I mean, he does nothing for 90% of the game. And why I say nothing, I mean, he's mostly just stood still with his hands on his hips, flapping his hands a bit at referees. And then that 10% where he goes, I mean, I think I saw a stat the other day that he recorded the top speed in that game against West Ham, which must have been over 5 yards because he didn't really sprint more than that at any point. But when he goes, it's unbelievable. And really, I would say to anyone listening, if you can get yourself to a game where he's playing this season, just go, because it is, you know, I think we maybe forget because we see so much of these guys on TV, but these real world-class players, to watch them live is extraordinary. And the thing with Ronaldo as well is there is always something happening with him in the game, whether it's a penalty appeal or a goal or a missed chat. Yeah, there is no game that goes by without him doing anything at all.
Mm. Dan, as you probably recall, when he was at United last time, their record against you was even better than it's been since. 15 games, won 14, drew 1. Crikey.
I'd say it's worth noting that Ronaldo's three favourite Premier League opponents in terms of goal output were Newcastle, West Ham and Villa, and he's already put 2 to the sword, so you wouldn't bet against him making it a third.
Right. Am I right in thinking this game's not available on regular television?
No, I don't think it is at all. No, I don't think you can watch it. No.
Mm. All right.
It's funny, isn't it, how quickly we became accustomed to being able to watch every single game. And then obviously United Newcastle wasn't on telly. There were Arsenal fans on Twitter last night who were exasperated by the fact that they couldn't find footage of the game anywhere, not even on any dodgy streams.
Really?
Yeah, it is. Well, apparently, yeah, that seemed to be the vibe. Not that I would endorse the use of dodgy streams, of course. But yeah, it is slightly perplexing to find a 12:30 game that isn't on telly.
Right. Well, next up from the Premier League, a bit of history.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. With Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which is handy for when Spurs stop pretending to be this ruthless winning machine and revert back to type. Ready for the fast bit? Pre-match bet builders only. Get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs. Max free bet £10. Excludes enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply. It's over 18s only. And please gamble responsibly.
History will be made on Saturday when referee Jared Gillett takes charge of Watford against Newcastle. The Australian official will be the first overseas referee to take charge of a Premier League match. 5-time referee of the year in the A-League. He came over to England, though, in 2019 to take up a postdoctoral research position at Liverpool John Moores University. He's got a PhD in biomechanics, which is pretty impressive. This is exciting news. I bet everyone's keen to watch Watford, even more keen to watch Watford Newcastle to see our first foreign referee.
Why does the Australian League have a Referee of the Year award? More to the point, why do we have Referees of the Year? Who would have been your referee of the year last year?
I mean, a Lifetime Achievement Award, Mike Dean, but I don't know. I don't know enough, Adam, to I mean, but there would be people who would. So I think rewarding areas of excellence in officialdom is a good idea. But broadly speaking, and I've seen you tweet this, Adam, actually, that if you can have foreign managers come in, and certainly foreign players, and even, let's be frank, foreign pundits enriching our enjoyment of the game, why not foreign referees as well? Because they do it in France, don't they, Tom?
They have done it in France. The example I was going to add to the hot ref chat pot was from Egypt. The Cairo derby between Al Ahly and Zamalek, the Clásico Al Arab, is such a stormy, frequently contentious fixture that they almost always bring in overseas referees, both for their professionalism and because there's a feeling that if they've come from, you know, Scotland, where actually quite a few referees have officiated this game, they're less likely to favour one team over the other. So it does happen.
All right. Scotland, by the way, have been importing referees for years. 12 years ago, Scottish referees went on strike over a lack of protection from criticism by the Scottish FA, and they were temporarily replaced with officials from Israel, Luxembourg and Malta.
Just broadly speaking, it's good to know that at a time when Britain is struggling to get a lot of imports into the country for various different reasons that we probably shouldn't go into, that we are at least able to still bring in the odd elite referee. So perhaps those supply lines haven't broken down completely yet.
Although he did come in 2019 and is now a resident.
There we go. Well, that's what we should have done then with all the other stuff.
You know how they used to put, do they still do this, where they put after the referee's name as if they're on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which county they're from? So it'd be, yeah. I don't know, Graham Pole from
Harrow,
Wiltshire or
Trim.
Whatever. Yeah, yeah. Are they going to have to put Jared Gillett's PhD after his name in the newspaper?
Well, I hope so. Doctor.
Dr. Gillett.
Jared Gillett. It's Gillett, not Gillette. I do apologise. Right. By the way, Tom, that business of the French doing it, there was a referee swap programme started this season between France and Portugal. So a Portuguese referee did Bordeaux against Lens recently, and the youngest referee in Ligue 1 history, the 28-year-old Willy Delajoie, I probably mispronounced that as well, also took charge of a Portuguese game, Passos de Ferreira against Braga. So, yeah, other countries looking to freshen things up a little bit in officialdom. I think we're losing Dan, though, so let's reference.
I was going to say, it's like pen pals gone wild. Or student exchange gone wild. Just the swapping element of it, I can't understand it. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. I don't get what the benefit is of it.
Well, you get a top official, you know.
But presumably, you're swapping a top official for a top official. Are you swapping a bottom rung referee for a top rung referee? I don't really understand what it is that's being gained. But maybe it's just me. All I know is that Mike Dean will be absolutely fuming that there's another referee in the Premier League that's getting a lot of publicity. Wow. He'd be livid. Indeed.
Do you know what would be great, actually, and might perhaps attract a bit more interest, is if the refs had to not just swap roles with the refs from other countries, but swap lives in a kind of Channel 4 wife swap scenario. So basically move into each other's homes for a couple of weeks. You could turn it into a short-running TV series and just see how Australian officials deal with, you know, the weekly Tesco run, in addition to all their refereeing responsibilities. Just an
idea.
And
being mic'd up as well, because they do that in Australia. Fantastic. In other news, winless Newcastle have only beaten Watford once in their last 10 meetings. Tune in on Monday to find out if this one went any better for them. We'll also, of course, come Monday, be talking about the North London Derby, the first North London Derby to be played in front of a full house since far off September 2019. Adam, last time you were on 3 weeks ago, Tottenham were top of the table and Arsenal were bottom. And you were expressing, I think, the doubts that many of us felt about their prospects. But look, they've risen all the way to, I think, 13th now. And if they win this match by 2 goals, they would actually be above Spurs, which is like a trophy or something.
I've been known to make predictions before Arsenal-Tottenham games, and that tends to go quite spectacularly wrong. So I won't go too strong either side on this. I think the two clubs are in pretty similar positions at the moment, where, you know, neither set of fans fully trust their players. I don't think either set of fans will be going into the game on Sunday you know, expecting to win. I think both there'll be a lot of anxiety from both sets of fans, but I think it will do a lot to shape the next month or so for both clubs. You know, if Arsenal to lose at home against Tottenham, that then becomes four defeats, and you're not even, you know, out of September yet. I think that becomes a massive problem for Mikel Arteta, and equally, I think Nuno, well, he needs his team to score a couple of goals from open play. So we're talking about, you know, pretty low bars, and I think it's probably a game where both teams would probably take a draw if they were offered it now and just get out of it unscathed and, you know, without lurching into another feeling of a crisis.
Wow, that's a big shout. Spurs needing to score some goals. Harry Kane's form currently so woeful, though, it almost sparked a major row last week between carpooling buddies Roy Keane and Michael Richards. If any game, though, is going to wake Kane up, it should be this one. He's got an incredible record in North London derbies.
He looked a little bit lost against Chelsea last week. People talk about lack of effort, doesn't want to be there. I just think he's lost. I think he's had average two touches in the opponent's penalty box compared to six last season. I think that was what I read earlier. So, you know, he's not even in the positions at the moment. He's always a notoriously slow start, but if there's any game he's going to come alive with that record of 10 of 13 in North London derbies, it's got to be this one, because if he doesn't, if I was a Spurs fan, I'd be pretty concerned.
Isn't he just playing the way that he did for most of the Euros? I know quite a lot was made of the fact he turned up against Ukraine, but actually for the rest of the tournament, he was pretty poor and looked a bit sluggish and languid. And, you know, then he didn't have a pre-season, and maybe we're just seeing, you know, what I would expect to see from a player that was out of form in the summer, didn't have a pre-season, you know, not entirely, you know, you would probably say mostly due to his own feelings at that time in terms of a full and proper pre-season, and now he's having to use Premier League games to get fully up to speed. So, you know, I can understand why Tottenham fans might feel a little bit frustrated. Obviously he's got a lot of credit in the bank, and he scored in the Carabao Cup against Wolves, which might help, but I don't think his form is necessarily a huge surprise on the basis of what's been happening over the past 4 or 5 months.
And also, Harry Kane never scores goals in August anyway, and we have very often found ourselves in September wondering when his season's going to get up and running, and then, you know, he'll score a hat-trick against someone, and then that'll be him up and away. I think the fact that he got that goal against Wolves in the Carabao Cup in midweek will help. You look at these two teams, and they are, as Adam says, in very similar positions. Arsenal started the season very poorly and have now found a bit of momentum from somewhere. Spurs, the complete opposite, you know, managed to grind out three wins and have, you know, go into this on the back of 2-3-0 defeats. I think Harry Kane's quality is the sort of thing that could decide this sort of game, which I suspect will be quite close and quite scrappy. I'm thinking error-strewn, slapdash defending, score draw.
But you say that both of these teams have only won 1-0 this season when they've won. It's been 1-0, hasn't it? Arsenal have won two in a row, 1-0. I think Spurs' first three games were 1-0 as well. So it seems to be all about the 1-0. But what struck me is, in my lifetime, it just feels like the most underwhelming North London derby ever. I just can't get excited about it. The players on show, the managers, it all just feels a little bit bleh.
Imagine if they had a foreign ref taking charge. That would really...
Yeah, it would add some juice. It certainly add some juice to it, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
The one thing that gives me hope about this game from a neutral perspective is that both managers picked quite creative midfields in their most recent league games. So Arsenal winning away at Burnley with a midfield three of Thomas Partey, Martin Ødegaard, Emil Smith-Rowe, which is quite a bold midfield three to be sending out in a Premier League game. And Spurs, you had Tanguy Ndombele, Dele Alli, Pierre-Emile Højbjerg and Giovanni Lo Celso, albeit Lo Celso sort of playing from the right. I think if both managers are similarly bold in their team selections, this could be quite easy on the eye, even if, you know, these are two teams who, you know, who look generally quite vulnerable.
I think the jeopardy of this game makes it very compelling. The potential for content that comes out of either side, you know, this going wrong for either side is quite high. I fear a 0-0. I don't know why, but I fear that, you know, there is so much to lose for both sides. I was just thinking, you know, to the other guys, I can't really remember a top four looking as clear so early in a season as it does this season. Can you see either Arsenal or Tottenham coming back to even compete for, you know, even for fourth place?
I'd say Arsenal are more likely to finish bottom four than top four.
Fell into that trap so beautifully.
In a word, no. It almost harks back to the days of the old Big Four before it became a Big Six, when you knew who the top four were going to be every single season, and that there is a clear gulf. I mean, Chelsea, Liverpool, Man City are three of the best teams in Europe. Manchester United finished second last season, have recruited extremely well. I don't see Arsenal and Spurs closing the gap. Leicester have made a poor start to the season. Obviously, you know, Brighton are up there at the moment. Everton haven't started the season too badly. West Ham have got a bit of momentum, but it does feel like that top four will be set in stone pretty swiftly.
All right. Well, let's talk about what awaits the other member of that leading quartet, Liverpool, next. Brentford.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Souness. Here's Johnston. Brentford wanted offside. And it went in off Ian Rush. 4-1. And again, Brentford have lost their discipline and their marking.
Brentford, Liverpool's first trip there in 38 years, coming up this Saturday tea time. October 1983, it was a 4-1 victory for Liverpool in the Milk Cup at Griffin Park. The players had to change in a porter cabin and then make their entrance to the field through a car park. Unperturbed Ian Rush and Graeme Souness amongst those on the score sheet. What was number one, October 1983?
I'm going to go... Can I go for like a Halloween-y kind of vibe?
Well, if you like. It was number one for ages, if that's any help.
It's not the Bonnie Tyler one.
No. Which Bonnie? Are you talking about Total Eclipse of the Heart? Yeah, that'd be the same period, wouldn't it? No, it was Karma Chameleon by The Culture Club. You know, which, of course, then Liverpool were... yeah, exactly. Now, Liverpool have made an almost perfect start. Can Brentford stop them? Fresh from their 7-0 win over Oldham. Can they?
Brentford have, by all accounts, been very, very good at the start of the season. And what is particularly impressive is how few goals they're conceding. They only conceded two in their first five Premier League games. You know, and you set that against a team such as Norwich, for example, who feel like they concede two every 15 minutes at the Premier League. You know, it's quite a big contrast. And it gives them the potential, you know, as the season goes on, to get those sorts of 1-0 victories that keep you up. As a newly promoted side, I think they'll have a proper go at it, and I think there'll be periods of the game where Liverpool look a bit ropey and uncomfortable. But Liverpool look really strong to me this season, because you know you've got Salah. I think Salah's probably as in form as any striker around. Mane is a bit hit and miss at the moment, but still very dangerous. But Van Dijk's such a big difference. I just trust Liverpool so much more with Van Dijk in the team, that you know that they will get through those difficult moments of games, and then their creative players finish it off. But I do think it'll be quite fun though to see Thomas Frank against Klopp in the dugouts. I think that has potential for good entertainment. And then, you know, I think any chance that we get to learn a bit more about this interesting Brentford team is good.
Liverpool statistics say won't lose unless Chelsea do earlier in the day, because They've had exactly the same score lines on each and every match day of this season so far, including, of course, the 1-1 draw with each other. Curious. Well, a little earlier on Saturday afternoon, but after the Chelsea game, Leeds take on West Ham. West Ham did the double over Leeds last season, and they've got Mikel Antonio back from suspension, who's possibly a striker who's even more in form than Mo Salah. Tom?
Yeah, I mean, Leeds haven't got going yet. You know, by this stage last season, you know, we were all singing their praises after they'd sort of arrived in the division, all guns blazing. And we've seen elements of that in their games so far, but five games without a win. They've shipped a not inconsiderable amount of goals, and away at Newcastle last time out, you thought that might be the sort of game that would help them get that first win under their belts. But actually, they were second best for large portions of the game. And obviously, you know, there's no pressure on Marcelo Bielsa. There's no sense that, you know, that the Leeds project needs a drastic overhaul or anything. But the longer this run of games without a win goes on, the more you do start to worry that they're going to struggle to replicate what they achieved last season. And West Ham, as we know, albeit, you know, having gone three league games without a win, are a very dangerous opposition. And with Antonio coming back in, that's obviously going to strengthen them even more.
I heard quite a feeble excuse earlier on today that the fans being back has affected Leeds, in that the communication is such a big part of how they play. Last season, when the grounds were empty, it was easier for them to communicate, so they could get instructions across it easier, and it was reflected with the results on the pitch, whereas they're struggling with fans being back and communication.
Interesting. Well, tough game, no question, at Noisy Elland Road for Leeds against West Ham. Elsewhere, contemporaneously, at 3 o'clock Saturday, you've got Everton taking on Norwich, perhaps a less tough fixture as they go. Everton, though, beaten last weekend by Downs. Villa knocked out of the League Cup by Championship QPR on penalties midweek. And also, James has gone to Qatar, sad face emoji. They are still sixth, the Toffees, just 3 points off the top of the table, but they've got a bit of an injury crisis going on up top. Norwich not much happier, bottom of the table, of course. Lost 15 Premier League games in a row. Destiny Claxon. Last time Norwich won a Premier League away game, guess where it was?
Goodison Park.
Yes. In fact, they've won on their last two trips to Everton in all competitions. But, hey, Dan, you saw them in the League Cup. Not going to happen this weekend?
I'm very, very worried about Norwich. I like the way they operate, and I understand the reasoning why they operate the way they do, but they just don't seem to have learnt much from the last time that they're in the Premier League. It's all very, very similar. And I know it was a reserve side pretty much against Liverpool on Tuesday, but they just look to me like they've got the same old problems. If you can't defend and you can't defend set pieces, and then you've got an attack that isn't really fluid and is full of goals. Pukki's okay, but you know he's probably not going to score more than 10 goals in the Premier League this season. I really, really worry for them. I think they're going straight back down from where they came from, to be honest.
A side a point above Norwich at the moment are Burnley, who are somehow kind of Teflon as regards relegation, or at least have been. They travel to Leicester. Burnley coming off a 4-1 win over Rochdale in the League Cup. All four goals scored by Jay Rodriguez. Will that buy him a start, do you think, away at the King Power?
No, Ashley Barnes and Chris Wood are immovable objects from that Burnley starting team, I imagine. I do fancy Burnley in that game to win, mostly because, as you say, they are Teflon from relegation. At some point, they are going to have to start winning some points, despite sort of the best efforts of clubs such as Norwich and Newcastle to, you know, protect teams such as Burnley from going down this season. I think Burnley, I think it's a sort of game where if Burnley were to score first, Leicester haven't made a great start to the season. I think they're struggling a little bit in terms of finding the best way to play, because they were playing with two up front, weren't they, towards the end of last season. Now they've gone back to just having Vardy up front. I think they're struggling a little bit, and I understand why they're struggling, because they've been quite relevant for the last couple of years, and now all of a sudden you're looking at them and thinking, what's the best they're going to do this season? Is it sixth, seventh? And that must be must feel a bit sad. You know, Brendan Rodgers maybe must feel, have I had my best moments at Leicester? Because of, you know, as Tom was saying before, that gulf between this top four and the rest feels larger and larger. And I think it's a little bit of an identity crisis for Leicester. as well. And, you know, you do have that issue with the side. Is it Daka up front that we've not really seen too much of yet? I think that's going to be quite an interesting thing to see how he starts getting in the team, what that means for Vardy. And I think James Maddison needs to try and rediscover a bit more of a flavour of his best form as well.
Okay. It was Brighton who beat Leicester last weekend. They will be in action this Monday, away at Crystal Palace, with Tarek Lamptey apparently available after 9 months out with a knee injury. The other game coming up this weekend, Southampton against Wolves, which is Sunday at 2 o'clock. Saints have drawn their last four Premier League matches. Wolves have won on four of their last five trips to St Mary's. And segue, ahoy, speaking of Wolves' record, Wolves Records. Did you see this exciting news that they've teamed up with Warner Music to launch their own record label called Wolves Records? It'll see performing artists benefit from the reach of a Premier League football club's global audience while also gaining access to Warner's marketing and distribution expertise. Crikey.
Will players be expected to contribute?
I don't know. Apparently they haven't got anyone signed up
certainly,
yet.
You'd certainly hope so. If there's not at least one terrible Wolves novelty record off the back of this, Connor Cody rapping unconvincingly, perhaps some harmonising from the Portuguese lads, then this will feel like a missed opportunity, I think.
Possibly it would be an Adama Traore number that would be a long player but doesn't finish properly and just fades out.
Or just doesn't ever finish.
Fabio Silva, breakthrough talent, finally start to repay some of his £40 million fee.
Possibly so. Well, this is, I think, by some distance, even in a week filled with curious news stories, the most eyebrow-raising, no?
Yeah, it's slightly curious. I mean, it's not totally unheard of. Marseille have got some kind of link-up with local musicians, but then Marseille has more of a reputation for music than Wolverhampton does, I would have thought.
What Wolverhampton got? I've got Roy Wood and Wizard is all I can think of. Were they from Wolverhampton?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know. I'm struggling.
Oh, Robert Plant. Yeah, that's a shout.
Okay, yeah. All right,
stand corrected. Robert Plant, says producer Charlie. Yeah, okay. Good. If you are a musician and you're from the Black Country, get in touch because they're looking for artists, apparently.
Apparently Slade are from Wolverhampton.
Wow, okay. So were Wizard from Wolverhampton as well?
Surely you can't have two of the greatest Christmas songs of all time from the same city.
But that's the thing. That would be extraordinary.
That must break some quota retirement somewhere.
All you would need now is Paul McCartney to have kind of emigrated north after a few formative years. Wizard, I'm hearing, from Birmingham. Yeah. Right, okay. Well, that's probably enough on Wolves' record label. Did you want to finish off with something particularly pithy about Saints' chances of making it five draws in a row or Wolves getting yet another victory there?
Well, we touched on Wolves' finishing problems, and that feels quite central to the issues they've been having so far this season. It felt like they'd got their season up and running with that win away to Watford and then were home to Brentford last weekend. You thought, right, well, you know, chance to put back-to-back victories on the board, but were well beaten. And I kind of feel like Raul Jimenez embodies a lot of the difficulties they're having. And I noticed that towards the end of that game against Brentford, he tore off his protective headgear, which he's obviously having to wear, you know, because of that awful injury he suffered last season. And from admittedly the little that I've seen of Wolves this season, it seems like he's getting in good positions quite a lot, and it just isn't really happening for him. There was also that very unfortunate failed Rabona that he attempted in the first half that didn't come off quite as he was hoping. But yeah, aside from that win at Watford, they haven't scored a single goal this season, Wolves, and I feel like that is not sustainable if they want to, you know, drag themselves away from the bottom of the table, because, you know, quality wise they're a top 10, top 12 team on paper.
Oh, nothing worse than a failed Rabona. Anyway, all right, well, there you go. That's a busy weekend in the Premier League, which we'll be reviewing in Monday's Totally Football Show. Very shortly, we'll touch on a couple of big stories from midweek in Europe. Barcelona, Messi, that kind of thing. But first, some odds from Paddy Power with producer Charlie.
Thank you, James. Thank you, listener. It's me, and it's Carl Monaghan from Paddy Power. Festival season might be over, but I'm seeing a couple of big headliners on the Premier League stage this weekend. First of all, Chelsea v Man City, Tuchel v Guardiola. It was 1-0 in the FA Cup semi-final. It was 1-0 in the Champions League final. Feels like it might be 1-0, Carl.
Yeah, Charlie, Thomas Tuchel really rocking Chelsea's world ever since he replaced Frank Lampard as their lead singer. The latest trick the German pulled was throwing on Kante last Sunday when it was 0-0 at the break and then sitting back with his feet up like a smoked teenager playing Championship Manager. It ended 3-0. No doubt the German is the real deal, folks, and his Chelsea outfit are starting to look like the real deal too. In regards to a 1-0 Chelsea win, well, everyone has a bogey team, Charlie, and Pep's Man City seem to have one very much so. In the form of Tuchel's Blues. A Chelsea 1-0 win is 7-1, Charlie. In terms of the match betting, it's 17-10 pick'em as the traders sit on the fence, whilst the draw is 21-10.
Interesting. And then we've got the North London derby. Harry Kane's only had 4 shots this season, but even when Kane isn't scoring, he always scores against Arsenal, even when he's not shooting. Same again on Sunday.
Well, the advice from Roy Keane, Charlie, last weekend was in order for Kane to regain his mojo, he was to run at a defender, knock him over, and then stand over said defender. Not sure about that one. Kane is yet to score in 4 PL outings so far, and his form looks to have plummeted since being chained up in Levy's dungeon for the last few weeks of the transfer window. He'll get 4-1 about Harry to be the first goal scorer in this one, and 7-5 anytime. Both will be popular. But the sight of the Gunners' shirt alone should get Kane's juices flowing again. And in the last 7 seasons, Kane has always managed to get at least 1 league goal against Arsenal, a decent record against one's biggest rivals. A fortnight is a long time in football, Charlie, and Arsenal's turnaround in league form comes at a time when Spurs have been on the end of 2 wretched results of late. But strangely, I think Santo could outmanoeuvre Arteta here and deliver the bragging rights to the white half of North London. Spurs look tempting at 21-10 to me, but the traders in Paddy Power don't see it that way, Charlie. Arsenal are the favourites at 13-10 and the draw is 11-5. I guess we'll see who'll be wearing the dunce cap come Sunday evening at 6:30, Charlie.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. They were doing midweek action in Serie A, Liga and La Liga in Italy. Among the delights was Bologna's 2-2 draw with Genoa, which saw their young Scots left-back Aaron Hickey becoming the first Scottish player to score in Serie A since Joe Jordan in far-off 1986. Extraordinary. Hickey having a much better time in this game than he did at the weekend when Denzel Dumfries left a big mark on him, I suppose you might say, on Hickey.
Hey.
Yes, yeah, 6-1, that was an Inter victory against Bologna. Anyway, Bologna are 7th, which is nice.
Is Hickey a universal name for a love bite in the whole United Kingdom?
Oh, I don't know. Well, does it work in Wales? What do they call it?
Oh, yeah, no, we call it Hickey in North Wales. I've never really thought about it. You know, it's...
Did you think it was a Welsh thing?
Well, it's just, you know, one of those things that you only ever hear about in a certain context. I wonder whether it might just be a North Wales thing or like a North Wales thing.
No, I don't think so. And I believe that the entire continent of North America also calls it a hickey. So,
Then I'll get back in my box.
Yeah. The tribesmen of the Kalahari probably also describe an over-affectionate love bite as a hickey. Anyway, in France, Tom, less happily, more crowd trouble. Angers-Marseille. Kind of appropriately, actually, marred by incidents at full time with the Marseille fans storming the pitch to confront their adversaries. It's becoming a bit of a thing.
It's the third time this season that we've seen this in Liga. Of course, there was a Nice Marseille game earlier on in the season that had to be stopped because of fans spilling onto the pitch. There was a Lens Lille game next weekend that was interrupted for about 45 minutes at half time for the same thing. And then last night, 0-0 draw between Angers and Marseille. I think one set of fans started lobbing firecrackers around or something, and the fans end up fighting on the pitch. And also, sadly, not directly related, but there was an accident involving some Marseille supporters travelling home after the game, and one fan lost his life. A bit of a grim night for Marseille fans.
Okay, I imagine there's been a lot of think pieces in France about what this wave of trouble is being sparked by.
Yeah, I mean, no one's really put their finger on the cause. There's been lots of talk about what appropriate punishments are. So for like the Nice Marseille game, Nice were docked a point, and the game was ordered to be replayed behind closed doors, and that's going to be later on this month. Lens Lille, I think Lens have been ordered to play behind closed doors until the LFP disciplinary committee can actually reach a definitive verdict on it, and I'm sure we'll see a similar thing off the back of that Angers-Marseille game. It feels to me like it's almost the product of fans being allowed back in stadiums again after, you know, the long, very difficult months of the pandemic. And it, you know, it has to be said, France has a pretty vibrant ultras culture. You do have people who go to games. There is a thuggish hooligan element to quite a few French top flight clubs, and I think a lot of this is probably to do with the fact that these guys have spent 18 months, if not longer, cooped up at home, not able to get on the terraces and express themselves as they usually would, and things are just spilling over. But it is worrying that you know, not even a full month into the season, we've already had three of these incidents. There was a bit of bother last night as well in the Mets PSG game. So it's a bit of a worry.
Was that Messi and Pochettino again?
That was not Messi and Pochettino, no. So in Messi's absence with a knee injury, it was left to Kylian Mbappe to be the sort of provocateur in chief. He appeared to try and lob the Mets goalkeeper when he was supposed to be giving him the ball back after Mets had put the ball out of play for a stoppage late in the game with the score 1-1 and very finely poised, which is obviously not the done thing in that sort of situation. PSG then scored a 95th minute winner, Achraf Hakimi getting a second in the game, and Mbappe saw fit to run up to the Mets goalkeeper, Alexandre Kidjer, who was lying flat on the turf, and basically just rub it in, you know, goad him over the fact that his team had lost. Ukidja then ran after him and was pushed over by Neymar. It was all a little bit Keystone Cops. But yeah, Kylian Mbappe's unexpected transformation into a bit of a heel is perhaps one to keep an eye on this season.
Did Mbappe do his sort of crying eyes meme where he sort of...
He didn't... He didn't exactly, but there was a new variation of it, which has been picked up by a few PSG fans on Twitter this morning. When Ukidja, the Mets goalkeeper, ran over to remonstrate with him while the PSG players were all celebrating, he hid behind a teammate, Mbappe, and then sort of popped his face around the corner with a sort of like, oh, don't be sad, look on his face, which was actually quite funny, despite the fact it was also grossly disrespectful.
All right, PSG are now 7 points clear with Marseille dropping points and potentially facing a points penalty after that trouble at the game against Angers. Crikey. Ooh, Messi's old club Barcelona. Ronald Koeman, the manager, causing a bit of a storm on Wednesday by turning up for his press conference and just reading out a statement and then leaving without taking any questions. This after a 1-1 draw with Granada last Monday, which saw his side compared to Stoke. 54 crosses... PK playing up front, all that kind of thing. Michael Cox saying, I desperately hoped that Stoke side had more Champions League winners than the current Barcelona. But sadly, says Michael, it seems to be 6-5 to Barca. Anyway, we'll get the latest on the Catalan Giants in next Tuesday's European edition of the Totally Football Show. A bit closer to home. Sadly, we hear that after Derby, Reading are the latest Championship side, potentially heading for a points deduction for breaching financial rules. Yeah. We'd heard a bit about their accounts on Monday's edition of the Totally Show. And in other news, the Premier League have reportedly agreed their break around the 2022 World Cup, which is troublingly in Qatar, as you know. Players will have a full week of preparations with the national sides before the tournament gets underway. And if they get to the final, they'll have a whopping 8 days to recover before the league gets started again. That's going to be significant, I feel. But for whom? Well, we'll see. But not much else they can do, I guess, in terms of making a space in the middle of the season.
No, it'll be quite a nice break, I suppose, for some players. You know, those who don't go to the World Cup will probably be completely revitalised. I think from a schedule point of view, it will all feel less weird because of the pandemic. You know, we're now very used to disrupted seasons and sort of things, you know, being a bit out of kilter. So, you know, that's purely from a schedule point of view. There's all just different kinds of concerns. But I do think actually the pandemic may have helped from that perspective. I'm still not quite sure, you know, I suppose when you have those summers where you have sort of pints flying in the air, we're just going to have sort of hot chocolates with marshmallows going sailing through London pubs.
Mulled wine, maybe?
Yeah.
Probably still pints.
Mulled pints.
Yeah, possibly. All right. Well, much to be pondered over. Re that tournament, which will see the Premier League stop on November the 12th and pick up again on Boxing Day. So that's fully 6 weeks off, which, as I say, feels like it's going to be probably quite significant.
Do we know if other leagues are going straight back into fixtures for sort of Boxing Day, 28th, 31st, or is that just like the Premier League wanting to miss out on that?
Miss on Boxing Day, yeah. It's a good question. I would imagine that it's got to be similar timings, although I've not seen any schedules announced by anybody else yet.
Well, some of the other European leagues have staged Boxing Day games, haven't they? Or at least have tried to kind of encroach on that territory, realising that currently it's basically just a week-long window where the Premier League is the only league you can watch. Is it Spain or Italy, maybe, who've had games around that time of year? I think a lot of other European cultures really kind of admire the whole like Boxing Day tradition. I know they do in France, so maybe this is a chance for them all to get a piece of the festive pie.
Yet another benefit of the 2022 Qatar World Cup. Fantastic. All right. Well, we return on Monday with our thoughts about the weekend. But for now, it's many, many thanks to Dan, to Adam, to Tom, and to producer Charlie, and you, listener. I don't need to name you because you know what your name is. Brilliant. Have a great weekend.
Oh, can I say...
Yes?
Sorry, James. Can I say happy birthday to my mum very quickly?
Does she listen?
Well, she claims to, but I think this would be a good opportunity.
Does she listen all the way past the...
Well, exactly. That's why I've left it to the very, very end. So we'll know for sure if she listens now.
Right. I guess we will. Excellent. All right. Happy birthday, Tom's mum. And from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.